Tonight on PBS News Weekend, buy now, pay later. What you need to know about the interest-free payment plans that are exploding in popularity. Then research into the connection between air pollution and degenerative brain diseases. And my conversation with Martin Luther King III on his father's legacy and the meaning of Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
Every year I'm asked the question, have we achieved the dream that your dad envisioned? And my answer, unfortunately, every year is we didn't achieve it last year. But every January we have an opportunity to start anew.
Good evening, I'm John Yang. California is bracing for another wave of heavy precipitation tonight. For nearly 3 weeks, incessant storms have overflowed riverbanks and swamped entire neighborhoods. Millions of people still face the threat of floods, and thousands remain under evacuation orders and warnings. President Biden has approved a disaster declaration for the state, freeing up federal funds for recovery, as residents used a brief lull in the storms today to clean up. Forecasters say an end is in sight. They're calling for warmer, drier weather later this week. In the Ukrainian city of Dnipro, the death toll from yesterday's Russian missile strike on an apartment building has risen to 30. One of the dead is a child. Today, search and rescue teams continue to comb through debris for survivors. Dozens are still missing. Yesterday's barrage of Russian strikes across Ukraine was the heaviest in weeks. Tens of thousands of Israelis took to the streets of Tel Aviv last night to protest their new hard-right government's push to overhaul the justice system. Demonstrators railed against proposals that include allowing a simple majority of lawmakers to strike down Supreme Court decisions. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who himself is on trial for corruption, remained defiant today, saying his government will move ahead with the proposals. In Nepal, 68 people are dead and four others are missing after a twin-engine propeller commercial airliner on a domestic flight crashed while trying to land. An eyewitness's video captured part of the plane's sudden final moments as it veered to its left and lost altitude as it neared the airport. It's the country's deadliest plane crash in decades. Those aboard included children and infants and citizens from eight different countries. The flight's destination is popular with trekkers. The weather had been clear, and the cause of the crash is unknown. And on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day weekend, President Biden took to the pulpit of Atlanta's Ebenezer Baptist Church. That's where Dr. King was a co-pastor in the 1960s, and where Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock is now senior pastor. The president said that Dr. King's words revealed a nation at a crossroads, both then and now.
He said, "Where do we go from here?" That's a quote. Where do we go from here? Well, my message to the nation on this day is we go forward. We go together.
Today would have been Dr. King's 94th birthday. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, my conversation with Martin Luther King III on his father's legacy, and a brief but spectacular take on suicide prevention.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
As inflation remains high, many consumers are looking at new ways to pay for the things they want. One that's gaining popularity is buy now, pay later. Companies like Affirm, Afterpay, and Klarna allow customers to take an item home right away and pay for it later in interest-free installments. But it's only free if you follow the rules. Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, how do these things work, and how are they different from using a credit card?
These are just splitting up payments into a down payment. Effectively, you imagine a $200 handbag, so you pay $50 up front, and you have maybe 2 months to pay the rest, sans interest and other things. So you're asking yourself, what's in it for the merchant? Well, the merchant is being promised by these vendors that you're going to get a much bigger size of the shopping cart, and we can also track data and the merchant will pay fees in lieu of interest. So this is, to the industry at least, it's innovation and not usury. But the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and others have kind of caught on because the sector has exploded, especially during the pandemic, and saying, well, maybe there are some usurious aspects, especially if you're layering on this onto your credit card, and it's buyer beware and, you know, debtor beware.
It's growing in popularity during the pandemic. Do we know what kind of consumer, what type of consumer this is popular with?
This has been huge with millennials and Gen Z. And if you just take millennials alone, right, considering the post-traumatic stress of the financial crisis and not being able to get jobs and seeing their parents with subprime and everything else. I mean, time was that the collateralized debt obligation or MBS was also financial innovation. So they might look askance at these credit card teaser rates and other things that, you know, 20-somethings might otherwise see their mailboxes stuffed with. So if you can avoid, I mean, it's a panacea. If you can avoid credit and all of its overhangs, what with reporting to credit bureaus and collection agencies and everything, and just take something and divvy it up into four, why wouldn't you do that? The thing is, you really have to read intense fine print. It's different among all of the different buy now, pay later players. And can you indeed get caught up in a vicious credit cycle? And I think a lot of these Gen Z and millennials and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau are kind of finding this out belatedly. It's always like this game of cat and mouse, as it was in subprime.
Well, explain how that happens. How are they getting into trouble?
Suppose it's linked to your credit card. I mean, so, okay, you agree to pay $50 on that handbag, on that $200 handbag, and we're going to take the money from your credit card over, say, 2 months. But if you're not paying the credit card and you have simultaneously many buy now, pay later engagements going on, what you're doing is effectively stacking onto credit. It will recourse back to you. If you get reported to a collection agency has to report that to the credit bureau. So you may have bought this initial premise that this is not a credit card, but in the end, it ends up hitting you and docking you much like a credit card would because it's linked to your credit card and you're not making payments, especially now if you're going away from kind of vanity purchases into everyday purchases, groceries, things that are costing a lot, and credit card interest rates are going up because the Fed has been taking up rates and we're in a higher interest rate environment. It seems like a recipe for a debt spiral.
And you talked about warnings. Is this regulated at all?
The argument is that it's not as regulated as it should be because, again, it's in the purview, the province of financial innovation, and it's supposed to be consumer friendly. A lot of these players are saying, we don't want to be like credit card companies. We don't want to be looked at that way. We want to usher in the new era of fintech and new banking that's kind of consumer facing and friendlier. But there is an underbelly to it. There is an underbelly when people accumulate rolling credit or whatever you want to call it, rolling balances, and they don't pay. And these are non-performing and they have to be written off. These are not charitable companies. They're not there to just ad infinitum, make zero interest rate credit extensions to people. They're going to collect and they're going to write off things that end up in the hands of the collection bureaus. And the credit card companies are going to have to deal with the second order effects. And so, yes, belatedly, you're seeing regulators come to this. You saw a report from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that says also we're monitoring how much information is sold because you're tracking everybody real time, their movements, how hesitant were they to consummate the transaction. That's all very profitable information. And end customers, especially younger people, might not know that they are maybe the product and not the customer.
Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you very much, Robin.
My pleasure, John. Thank you.
New research is raising important questions about the effect of air pollution, not only on our lungs, but on our brains. It's what one study called an urgent public health concern. The issue, how much and to what extent are airborne contaminants linked to neurological diseases like Alzheimer's? Jeffrey Brown has more.
Research in this area has been building for years with many links now seen, but much still uncertain. Dr. Deborah Corey-Slechter focuses her studies on environmental health and the brain at the University of Rochester Medical Center, and she joins us now. Thanks for being with us. You know, you and others see a growing public health issue here. Explain the concern. I mean, how does air pollution impact the brain and possibly lead to neurological disease?
Well, we've known that air pollution has effects on the heart and the lung for a very long time, but it's really only been in about the past 10 years that attention has been directed to its effects on the brain. And over that period of time, there's been a growing body of scientific evidence showing associations between exposures to air pollution and a real wide variety of neurological diseases and disorders. It has included neurodevelopmental disorders like autism, attention deficit, hyperactivity disorder, as well as neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, et cetera. How that's happening, we still don't fully understand, but the fact that it seems to have such a impact on such a variety of neurological diseases and disorders suggests that instead of acting on what are the real unique characteristics of each of those diseases and disorders, air pollution is acting on the features that are shared across these neurological diseases and disorders.
Well, so to be clear, at this stage, it's a question of association of pollution to neurological problems, but not yet clear causation. Is that fair?
I think there is a growing body of experimental data linking or directly showing causal relationships. Air pollution is a very complicated exposure. It's really a mixture of gases and particles, and those particles carry other toxins on them, metals and organics that get into the brain. And so what we really don't understand, one of the things we don't understand is what are the contaminants that are getting into the brain via those air pollution particles that are responsible for these neurological diseases and disorders.
As you're studying this, who do you consider most at risk, whether it's by age or by living conditions or geography? Who are you most worried about?
Well, I think we don't fully have the answers to that yet. So one of the things we don't yet understand with respect to, for example, neurodevelopmental disorders is what is the period of greatest vulnerability? Is it preconception or is it in utero, first, second, third trimester, early brain development? We don't know the answers. And with respect to neurodegenerative diseases, one has to remember that this is actually a lifetime exposure. Are neurodegenerative diseases being caused by cumulative exposure over the lifetime, or is it exposures that are occurring later as maybe the blood-brain barrier begins to break down, gets a little bit leaky? We don't have answers to those questions as of yet. We really need to understand what the contaminants are that are in air pollution that are causing these, because then we could go and basically set regulatory policies that might assist in preventing those exposures.
Are there things you do advise to individuals to in terms of behavior or care in this regard?
Well, I don't know that there's much an individual can do. This is really going to be at a national level. We do regulate right now levels of air pollution with specifically what we call PM 2.5 and PM 10. Those are particle sizes. But we know that it's actually the smallest particle size, the ultrafine particles, the nanoparticles, that are the most problematic. They are what carry those toxicants into the body. And we don't regulate those right now. We don't have a system in place to fully assess the data of those kinds of exposures. And so a lot more effort is going to be needed to address this ultrafine particle component.
Deborah Corey Slekta, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Today is the 94th birthday of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and Monday is the federal holiday honoring him. Since the 1990s, Martin Luther King Jr. Day has been a day of civic, community, and service projects. Martin Luther King III is Dr. King's eldest son and a global human rights advocate. Mr. King, thanks so much for being with us today. This April, it will be 55 years since your father's assassination. Obviously, the world lost a leader that day. You lost a father. You lost your dad. What are your personal remembrances and thoughts looking back for you and your family looking back over these past 55 years?
Well, number one, every year I'm asked the question, have we achieved the dream that your dad envisioned? And my answer, unfortunately, every year is we didn't achieve it last year. But every January, we have an opportunity to start anew. If you ask me about what I'm often thinking about, I have to remember the wonderful experiences. I only had a very short period of time with my dad, 10 years. But I did travel with him to see him in the context of his work. I did march with him. I did visit him at his office. We did go on some vacations from time to time. And so all of those kind of experiences, we rode bicycles together, I think about particularly in January when we observe his birth.
What do you think his legacy is today?
He was a human being who was able to bring people together, groups that didn't necessarily always agree. He was a coalition builder. And we need more coalition leadership today. We're at the most divided time probably that we've ever been in the history of our nation, particularly our political leadership. Dad used to say, we've got to inject nonviolence. He wanted to eradicate the triple evils of poverty, racism, and violence from our society. And clearly, there's a lot of work that we have to do for those things to be eradicated. So I hope that people are renewed and get engaged in a way that they maybe have not been engaged in the past.
What do you think he'd be focused on today? And in these divided times, what do you think would be animating his work today?
Every campaign he was involved in, he talked about voting rights and the expansion of that franchise. He used to say that a voteless people is a powerless people. And one of the most important steps we can take is that short step to the ballot box. Our rights are being restricted in 2023 in a number of states, including my own state of Georgia, as opposed to expanded. We should be able to vote just like we pay our bills on computers. We shouldn't have to even go to the polls unless we choose to. So I know he'd be focused there, but he'd also be focused on, again, the violence and poverty that exist in our society. We talk about like 60 or so million, but there are far more than that who are living in poverty. That's unacceptable in a nation that has such a vast amount of wealth. And then, of course, our violence is busting out at the seams. That has got to change. Dad used to say, we must learn nonviolence or we may face nonexistence. We do not want to face nonexistence, so hopefully we will learn nonviolence someday.
Well, I'm curious what you think about the fact that the day honoring your father has become a day of service.
That was certainly something my mother intended when she and others helped establish a holiday. She went to visit every United States senator and many members of the United States House of Representatives. It was not ever supposed to be a day where our traditional holidays are kicked back, relaxing, going out and having a sale of some kind. This was always directed towards working to achieve and realize, the dream that he had of freedom, justice, and equality for all humankind.
I know that you and your family have come up with a reading list of materials not only by your father, but about your father. Why did you do that, and what is it that you want people to know, or especially younger people to know about your father?
Well, I think the best way to understand about Martin Luther King Jr. is to read his own words and work. One specifically, I'll mention, while there are several we recommended through WorldCat, which is an app that encourages people to read. And one of those is called Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community? My dad wrote that as his last book in 1967. And what he is talking about is the World House and how we work together to actually achieve components of the dream he envisioned. We've seen chaos. We must embrace and build community. Secondly, a book called Strength to Love. It's a book of sermons. And each one of those sermons of his talks about what has taken place through the modern civil rights movement and gives us instructions on what we could and should and can be doing to make our nation better. But again, the main goal is to encourage people to read. And if you want to know about Martin Luther King, why not read his own words that he actually wrote that give us examples of who he was and what we all can become?
Martin Luther King III, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Amelia Nora Shiro describes herself in many ways: a Muslim woman, an educator, an activist, and a suicide survivor. Through her advocacy work, she is using science and research to help others who are experiencing suicidal thoughts. Tonight, she shares her brief but spectacular take on cross-cultural suicide prevention research.
Being a survivor of suicide attempts is not just like this final occasion where from then on you're no longer suicidal. It is, for me, definitely this active decision every single day to wake up and choose life. My experience was sort of just a really deep sense of hopelessness. I was definitely actively suicidal during grad school for about 3 years. One of my first out of multiple suicide attempts was postpartum, when I had my first daughter back in 2015. I had subsequent attempts, which actually got me hospitalized. I had 2 involuntary hospitalizations. I became so hopeless about my own survival that it made more sense to just end the suffering and not continue. From my perspective, as someone who kind of straddled both American identity and Muslim identity, and of course my ethnic background being South Asian, it was quite confusing to kind of conceptualize suicide. It almost seemed like a foreign concept, almost as if, you know, Muslims aren't impacted by suicide, so why discuss it? I didn't actually speak up necessarily about my mental health to my mom. It's as if you would be offending the culture, almost. It would be considered sort of a direct attack to how much effort she has put into taking care of me. I knew I couldn't be the only one. I knew this was a more universal experience than we're realizing. And I knew that I would have to try and bring my own lived experience as a survivor and eventually come out as a survivor in order to move the needle scientifically and politically and socially. I chose to be a scholar activist, someone who does research, because I believe that if we get scientific representation about the issues that we're facing, if we can get data, if we can get numbers, and numbers don't lie, if we can get epidemiological evidence of how much we are suffering as a Muslim community, then we can get political representation. So in my mind, scientific representation equals political representation. I have 2 kids. I have a 7-year-old and an almost 2-year-old. I truly believe that if we are to be effective as parents and if we want to heal and not pass on this intergenerational trauma that we've come from, that our parents have come from, that our ancestors have held in their bodies, then we have to do the work. My name is Amelia Nora Shiro, and this is my brief but spectacular take on cross-cultural suicide prevention research.
Now online, our guide to the restrictive immigration program known as Title 42 and what President Biden's controversial expansion means for migrants crossing the southern border. All that and more is on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is PBS News Weekend for this Sunday. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. Have a good week.